Hi, everybody. Thanks for coming. I'm Jim Kudal from Kudal Partners in Chicago, and this is Brendan Dawes from Magnetic North in
Hello.
Manchester, UK, and from BrendanDawes.com.
My mom's in the audience.
When we originally decided to do this topic, which was embracing the benefits of having a really short attention span, we were really excited about it, really enthusiastic. But now, by this time, we're sort of over it, so I hope it works out okay. I'll introduce us in a minute. It does occur to me that this entire thing may be just a rationalization for the fact that I'm good at starting things and terrible at finishing them. So, but I'll rationalize first, and then Brendan, and then we'll go from there. But I'll start with a quick story. Last summer, I heard, or someone told me, that they had struck some new prints from Terrence Malick's film Days of Heaven, which is one of my all-time favorite American films, and that the prints were going out on tour, and they were going to be in Chicago. One of the new prints was going to be in Chicago. And I'd seen the film a number of times before and loved the films. I've even seen it projected a long time ago, but we decided to go to the movie, and we saw it at an art house in Chicago. And it's spectacular. Nestor Almendros is the cinematographer. It's just great. If you've never seen it, you've got to see the movie. And after the movie, we're walking out in the lobby, and people were having these really interesting discussions about the film, the kinds of discussions that people don't have when they watch the film sitting next to each other, watching a DVD, or even watch it separately and talk about it later, really interesting intellectual discussions about the film. And we went out to eat, and we were talking about this more and more, and it occurred to me that maybe there's an idea here, that maybe there'd be some sort of a concept to do some sort of a film club or a film series in which on cold Mondays in the winter you would show a series of films, and not like an art house thing or a university film series, but like real accessible great American films like Chinatown and The Conversation and Days of Heaven and Being There and other films that people of my age and younger have probably all seen but probably never seen projected. Sort of enthusiastic about the idea, and the next day I went into work and talked to the crew at Kudal Partners about it, and everybody was very excited about it. We really got to work on it. We started to do research about digital projection systems against analog systems, and how does one go about renting 35mm prints of films, and what venue we could do this at in Chicago, and we cranked up a spreadsheet and tried to figure out how much we would charge for such of a thing, and we came up with a name for it. We were going to call the series Projected, and the tagline was, I'm in the dark, and got very excited about it. I even did a complete logo design, an identity design based on a vintage logo from the Bolex Corporation, who makes cameras. Well, that's sort of where it came from. That's sort of the logo. And then something came up at work, and it was a big client project or something. So we had to get away from Projected. And then something else came up. We had some idea we were going to do on the website, and so we talked about Projected less and less. And eventually, we stopped talking about Projected altogether. Eventually, we put Projected in the book. And what the book is, I'll talk about it later, but it's a repository for unborn ideas. And it might seem like this is a failure. And if it's not a failure, maybe it's just a tremendous waste of energy and time. But actually, I look at it as one of our great successes. Because, first of all, we got that spark of enthusiasm working on a new idea completely out of left field, which is what we're in this business for anyhow. Secondly, we learned a lot of things about how the movie business works and projection in the movie business works and stuff that, you know, maybe we'll do Projected at some point. But if we're not, this information is going to be valuable at some point. And the business modeling, going through the business modeling process is always valuable. And I got to design a cool logo for a cool brand with no client, and I could do that all day long. I mean, that's like my favorite thing. But most importantly, I think, and what Brendan and I are going to talk about today is we got to dream about that idea. We got to dream about that idea in reality. We took it far enough that we could see this event happening. And it's as if we had the experience of creating Projected without all the sort of details about getting people to sign up and building the website and everything else. So that's sort of what we're talking about today. To embrace your short attention span, and to try ideas just because you can try them. Brendan Dawes is the executive creative director for Magnetic North in the UK, in Manchester. They do a lot of innovative, great work for big, important companies. I know Brendan because a long time ago, and this is sort of the beginning of a recurring theme, because he could, Brendan did a site as a tribute to the great designer Saul Bass, the great motion picture title sequence designer Saul Bass. And so I saw that site. And then after that, before a lot of people were putting video up on the web, Brendan created a sweet Flash application that allowed users to re-edit Alfred Hitchcock's shower sequence from Psycho. And as far as I could tell, nobody did as good a job as the original. But I don't know, maybe you have some other things. At the same time, at Kudal Partners, because we could, we were doing this thing called Photoshop Tennis, in which we invited two fairly well-known designers to swap a Photoshop file back and forth and post their updates to the web live in real time. And then we would have a third person do play-by-play and wisecrack about it. And it was very popular. A lot of people came to watch it every Friday. And so Brendan and I became friends through that. And when we had this idea about doing a session about sort of embracing your short attention span, I sort of made a list of the people who are as scatterbrained as I am, and Brendan was the only name on it. So that's why I invited Brendan. If you're a Flash monkey or you have a Flash programmer in your studio, you probably have Brendan's Drag Slide Fade book in your library at your studio. And you should have his new book, which is called Analog In, Digital Out, which is out fairly recently, which is ostensibly about interface, musings on human interface, but really it's, if the interface...
You just have to say it's a work of genius.
It's a work of genius. Another benefit of, and so I'll go for a minute and then Brendan will go. Another benefit of just trying things because you can, or trying ideas that are completely off the wall, is that we know a lot of people, and probably a lot of them are in this room, that have started building things, companies and web apps and fashion companies and music companies and made films. And almost to a person, every one of them has started out trying to build A but wound up building B or D or X. That the idea is that you need to be moving to sort of do anything. And I was talking about this with Josh Williams, who's here today, who built BlinkSale. His company built BlinkSale and Icon Buffet, and he put it in an interesting way yesterday. He said that's because it's much easier to steer a moving ship than steer a ship that's stuck in port. So that's another benefit. And as a sort of a metaphor for that, I'll introduce our company a little bit. Kudal Partners is a small design shop in Chicago. We make we do creative work for clients, and we do creative work for our own businesses. And we did quite a couple of years ago. Some friends of ours, Eric and some friends of ours, who own a production company called Slowtron, a film production company, had this idea to do a series of films because they could. The films are a series of short vignettes about particular artists, guys like Jeff McFetridge and Andy Mueller and Jason Genevico. And the series is called Western State, and it's still on our site, and the films are really cool. You should check them out. But anyhow, at the same time at Kudal, we were trying to figure out a way to free ourselves from clients, that we don't mind doing the client work, but we didn't want to do all client work because we were always at somebody else's beck and call, and we didn't have, we weren't reaping the benefits of our own creative work, so we were trying to come up with ways that we could develop our own brands. Well, once Western State went up on our site, it was very popular, and we got a call from a UK television distributor who was interested in making Western State into an episodic television series. And we're like, wow, this is awesome. We have this idea that we're going to make our own company, we're going to make our own products, and we launched this film series, and here it is. Well, that didn't work. That's not an episodic TV series anywhere, and the guy wasn't even that interested in it, apparently. But because we did that, when we were preparing the DVD to send to the UK to become famous flashy Hollywood producers, we were pretty unsatisfied with the options that were available to us to package the DVD. And so we created this company called Jewel Boxing out of that. And at Jewel Boxing, we sell high-end DVD and CD packaging systems to creative professionals for doing short runs of their reels or their album or their film or whatever. And so sort of that B, that idea B, came out of what we thought we were doing with idea A. And it doesn't stop there, because after we launched Jewel Boxing, a couple of guys that we knew who were trying to reinvent the way individual concert performances were recorded and distributed we're looking for a partner who had some design capabilities and some production capabilities, which we had, and we're also looking for somebody who knew a little bit about selling on the web, which we didn't know very much about, but we pretended like we did. And so we started another company called The Show. And what The Show is we send people out on tour with bands, and then we record, mix, master, design, manufacture, market, and fulfill CD recordings of specific concert performances for bands like the Pixies and Dead Can Dance and a couple of festivals this summer and a big dinosaur heavy metal group that I can't talk about who's going on tour later in North America. So there's The Show. So again, this producer who was interested in this video series, which is now a long way ago, is responsible for our two main sources of income at Kudal. But it doesn't even stop there, because for The Show and for Jewel Boxing, we needed to advertise. And the process of buying ads on individual blogs and trying to find the target market is a real pain. And we were running a little ad experiment on Kudal.com, which is our home site, and that's a pain. And as readers of the web, looking at the way ads were distributed on the web, irrelevant Google ads, awful Punch the Monkey ads, all this other stuff. So out of that came the deck. And the deck is a ad network that we put together with some people that we know and respect that allows people to buy ads on our sites. There's 15 sites in the deck now, a list apart, Daring Fireball, Design Observer, Cocky, Waxy, The Morning News, Signal versus Noise, Computer Love, Helvetica, The Film, Subtraction, Airbag, Swiss Miss, Zeldman, Yay Hooray, and Kudal Partners are all in the deck. And advertisers can access all of those aggregate audiences by buying a single schedule on the deck. And we actually it's actually working. So I don't know where it's going to go from there. So that's sort of an example of how pulling the ship out, thinking you're doing one thing, can turn into something else. And while we were building these businesses, we really didn't even see the connections between them until we looked back and saw that it all was because of the film series Western State. But don't tell Eric and Drew from Slowtron, because I don't want them thinking we owe them something. So it looks from the outside like at Kudal Partners we are just screwing around all the time, and we are letting ourselves be distracted by whatever shiny object today's sun is shining on. But the reality of the situation is that we're screwing around every day, and we're letting ourselves be distracted by whatever shiny object today's sun is shining on. And someone said about us one time that it seems like all we do is follow our whims to their logical or illogical conclusions. And we usually say that we're okay with that, except the dirty little secret is there's hardly ever a conclusion. And I think that that's part of what it's about that we're talking about today, is this ability to just sort of do things because you can do them and follow your inspirations and your enthusiasms to some sort of natural or unnatural ending point. And this doesn't only apply to like building businesses or making a brand or making some sort of a product that you can sell. I think the way that we work at Kudal in terms of the design we do is very much the same. We tend to be restarters and not revisers. We tend to take a project and take it as far as we can take it until we know for sure that it's not right, and then throw it out and start again, as opposed to taking something and making it cool and then trying to figure out a way to shave the corners off it so it sort of fits in what the brief for the project is. It might take a little bit more time, but I think that the actual work that comes out of that design process is more wholly significant to the brief or to the solution than continual revising of an idea to make something that was created maybe inauthentically fit into something else. So, and it also is true of many of the oddball web features that we do at our site. Very quickly, somebody at our office had this idea that we were going to do this deal where people would call a phone number at our office and perform dialogue from a movie. And I don't know why we got so excited about it, but we thought this was like the greatest idea ever. And so we got a name for it, we built a web page for it, we got the phone number and everything, and we launched it, and nobody called. And I mean, like, I don't mean like a few people called. I mean like no one called. Like for 5 days, the only message on our machine was my sad test message, reading E.E. Cummings, so it was really awful. Or whatever, reading from I think I did Raging Bull. It was awful. So we bailed on it. But we had been so enthusiastic that we had reserved the phone line for 2 months, so we decided we had to do something, and we decided to do a poetry meme. And I suppose you think, these guys have some great ideas, like the poetry meme, that's the next YouTube, you know? So and we asked people just to read their favorite short poem into our answering machine. We call it Verse by Voice, and that's still on our site, and you can listen to some of the poems, and they're absolutely beautiful. There's no, this is not a business decision at all, but some of the poems that people have read are just spectacular. And tons of people did. In fact, one morning, I go in early and I'm listening to them. It's so great to come in the morning and listen to all these people. And of course, there's a lot of people reading their own poems after drinking too, and that was sort of fun. But I hear this British voice, this woman's British voice, and she's reading Frank O'Hara's Animals, which is one of my all-time favorite poems. And it's just beautiful the way she's reading. And at the end of it, she says, "This is Zadie." And I'm like, oh, shit. I think that's Zadie Smith. Zadie Smith, the British novelist who wrote On Beauty and other things, great novelist. But I'm like, or maybe somebody's pulling our leg. And so the next, everybody comes into work and I play it for everybody. And the web being what it is, everybody knows somebody who's related to somebody else. And Steve at our office says, oh, I know a guy who used to date her. I'm like, cool. So he plays the Frank O'Hara poem for this guy that goes, oh, that's definitely Zadie. Not only is that her voice, but I know that's her favorite poem. So that didn't make us any money or do anything, but that was a really cool day at work. Anyhow, I guess I'm kind of going slow, so I'll go fast. I have two suggestions for how to integrate this sort of dreaming, sort of short attention span into your creative work and into your studio. And one of them is practical, and the other one is maybe not so practical. And the first one is paint all the walls in your bathroom with that paint that makes them into chalkboards. Because everybody has to go to the bathroom a couple times a day, and people can't resist colored chalk. So you wind up with interesting ideas in the washroom. And the other thing we have is we have this thing called the book. And what the book is a holding place for ideas that we probably will never do. Maybe we'll do. Sometimes things come out of the book. Usually when they're in the book, they're gone. But the book legitimizes this sort of dreaming kind of aspect of creative. Because if you write it down, you're making it real in a way that talking about it at the bar after work doesn't make it real. And the book is full of like one-line ideas, like the million-dollar porn page, which thankfully we didn't do. Although, whatever, if anybody does it, let me know. And other ideas like the projected ideas in the book, more fully formed ideas like that. We had an idea called Click Stakes, where we were going to have two bloggers write a post about the same thing, post them anonymously next to each other and see which one got the most clicks and figure out who's the best linker in the world. We actually wrote the code for that, but then we tried it. It wasn't very much fun. So, and a number of other oddball ideas that we've had are in the book. And I think the important thing there is to institutionalize this sort of thinking and to authenticate this sort of thinking, this sort of dreaming by making note of it, much like a visual artist might do with a sketchbook. My grandfather, an old Dane, was a notorious note maker. He would scratch little scrawled notes on the corners of newspapers and on envelopes, and he would always lose them. And one day I asked him why he did it, and he said, "I'm not writing this down to remember it later. I'm writing it down to remember it now." And I think that's sort of a really interesting point, and I think that goes to carrying a sketchbook, and that goes to us having this goofy thing called the book at Kudal. Like, at some points, people come in now with ideas, and they say, right before they start, they say, "This one's for the book." Like, they know already that we're never going to do the idea before they've even said a word. But it makes, it opens, the book is open for any and all ideas. So, that sort of idea. Now, somebody else who does a lot of things because they can is Brendan, so I'll let him take it from here.
Thank you, Jim. I've got a few slides. So I need my slides like a comfort blanket. So let me just fire this up. Work. It's interesting that Jim mentions, you know, the word sketchbook and stuff. And I'm a great believer in pencil and paper and stuff. But I also have this drive that I have with me. And that's like, I use that as kind of a digital sketchbook, and it's just full of crap. I recently upgraded it from a 10 gig one that I had for 5 years. I thought, I need a bigger one. I go, because it's full. And now I've got an 80 gig one, And I'm thinking, but 90% of the stuff on that drive I never, ever use. So I could have just cleared it out, but consumption culture have to get a bigger drive. That's what you do, especially in America. So, okay, so we're going to rewind slightly and tell you a little story. This is me. Yeah, make more dramatic effects. This is... It doesn't make me look better. This is me over 10 years ago. You're thinking, what the hell happened? Or maybe you're not. Those hairstyles were in at the time, so... So this was at the time when I had this idea of doing this site about Sol Bass. And the reason I did this, and with this talk about dividends, you, straight away you think of money, but it's not necessarily just about the money. It's also about reputation and PR and all those kind of things and creative process and experimenting. So with the Sol Bass site, I thought, well, no one's ever done anything about Sol Bass at the time. And there's still very little about him on the web. So I decided to do something about it and do something that hadn't been done at the time, using a lot of Flash and that kind of stuff and trying to integrate, you know, the look of Sol Bass into a Flash interface. And it was kind of an experiment. So probably a lot of people have seen it, hopefully. And it got me a lot of PR and it hooked me up with people like Jim and gone, I think we've got a problem with the technology here. That's actually supposed to be red. There you go. Right. Oh, it's interactive. That's what this is. There you go. Right. So I did this site and it hooked me up with people like Jim. And through this, I met Hillman Curtis, who we started to do work together and became good friends. So the dividends for me on this was tenfold. It was a PR thing. It made a lot of connections with some great people and it was great. And then, because of this short attention span thing, the domain expired. The domain has expired 3 times and now I'm my third domain, which is pathetic, I know, but I'm not losing this one. Originally it was solbass.co.uk. And for one reason or another, didn't see the email, domain expired, and I was shit. So I then had to like move to solbass.com. I thought, that's even cooler. So anyway, I get this email from this guy and he says, I've got solbass.co.uk. I've bought it. I was like, oh, cool. He says, I'm going to do a site on Sol Bass. Even cooler. Let's get, you know, more stuff out there about this great guy, more resource. It's great. And it didn't bother me. And then on the bottom of his email, he just sort of said, yeah, because your site doesn't really cover it properly. And, you know, he's having a little dig. I was like, whatever, dude. But, so, you know, people say these kind of things. And so you can go to the site now. This is like 5 years ago I got this email. And if you have a look at the site now, and this was this morning, here it is. Fucker. Right, so... The difference is I'm on stage at South by Southwest and he is probably filling shelves. No, I'm not just come all this way to have a go at this guy, but I don't even know him.
It didn't bother you a bit.
Yeah. So the point is this, that, well, there's several points, but the main point is that if you're going to do something, get the stuff out there, make it. And even if it isn't finished, just do it. And I have so many things. I've met so many people over the years. It's like, I'm going to do this great idea, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, nothing ever happens. And it's great having a short attention span, but make that short attention span. Just make some stuff, even if it's like half-assed. It doesn't matter. Get it out there. Let people talk about it because you don't know where it'll lead. So it's just about making stuff happen. Now, I want to rewind a little bit further. So I think short attention span is also about constraints. And I think any designer in the room will tell you that, and coders as well, that constraints is a fantastic thing. Having too much freedom in a creative process is usually very, very bad. And constraints help you to focus your ideas. And this is how I got into computing. I'd bummed around doing loads of jobs. I've been a photographer. I've been a DJ. I used to sell bootleg mixes. I've always done lots of bootleg stuff, actually. Films, editing the Psycho movie illegally and all that stuff. You know, I just take the risk, but not ended up in prison yet. So anyway, I did all these kind of different things. But one of the things that really resonated with me was computers. And I got, for Christmas, off my granddad, it was, a ZX81. How many people here know the ZX81? And yeah. And I think for a lot of our generation, yeah, we grew up with this thing. And it was, you know, a real powerhouse of creativity. It was, it had 1K of RAM. 1K. You can't put a banner ad in 1K. 1K of RAM. I did have a 16K RAM pack, so I was the daddy. And I was the man. But what I absolutely loved about it was you switched it on. You basically, it's black and white, no sound. You put it into your TV, and it said Sinclair Research, copyright Sinclair Research at the bottom. And then there was just like a cursor. It booted up straight away because there was nothing to boot up. So, and then there was just this cursor just sat there like this, flashing at you. And it was as if to say, come on, then. It was like baiting you, because you had, and the point is this, you had to make something. You had to do, because there was nothing to do. You know, it was, you had to start typing some code. Now, the first thing anyone ever does when they work with, like, this was BASIC it used, basic programming language, and it was a great way to get into programming. But for me, it wasn't about the numbers or just geeking out or just like seeing what you could do. It was more about what would be the creative output of that. And so the first thing I did was, you know, within the first hour, I'd made my first little program. And then we have this really crap electronics store in England. It's called Dixon's. And it's really bad. And they've been going years, and they were going back in the day. So I hated them. And when the ZX81 came out, they had all these TVs lined up in the store. And so I would go in, because, you know, and this was like my first public installation. I'd go in and I'd write this little three-line program, or two lines, and it would just put the word cock on the side of every, you know, fill the word like cock and penis. And I'd just walk out the shop and, you know, with loads of cocks behind me. Not for the first time. So what that gave me, I moved on and did other things, you know, because I was bored with that then. So, but I just thought, God, this is so empowering. This is me having my say at these bastards who are crap. And, you know, and it was like, you know, pre-blogging, before there was blogs and there was public installation and all that sort of stuff. So, I want to take you through a few projects that sort of encapsulate that whole experimentation and taking a risk attitude, and this whole like flitting around from one thing to the other. And I dabble in all sorts of stuff. You know, one minute I'll write some PHP. Next minute I'll do something in Photoshop. You know, maybe mess with, I've done JavaScript before, Flash stuff, blah, blah, blah. And I mean, all programming is the same, essentially. It's just the concepts is always the same. So it's, and then you ask yourself questions like this, you know, why do we have to watch a DVD in a DVD player? Well, that's what they say we have to do. Well, we don't have to. You do if you want to make sense of a DVD, obviously, but you can take information and twist it into other forms. So this was, you know, this was an experiment on a Saturday afternoon or a Saturday morning, or, you know, messing about at work. And, you know, this was a program that took half an hour to write. Dead tiny thing. Not rocket science at all. what do rocket scientists say when they're on stage with that? But making that point. So what this did, I wrote this little thing. I just thought, what if you take a frame, every frame from a DVD, and instead of displaying it on screen in a 4:3 or 69 aspect ratio, you display every frame 1 pixel wide. What would that do? And then lay that out constantly. So there's like 700 frames there because it's a 700 wide image. So there's 700 frames and then there's two iterations of it. And that's what happened. And this is the film Don't Look Now with Donald Sutherland, which is, I know is one of Jim's favorite movies. And so I did this and it was kind of weird because Don't Look Now has this theme of red running through it. And you can see that it was like this weird, you know, bands of red, and you can see Donald Sutherland has just discovered his daughter's drowned at the beginning of the movie. And you can see the anguish is even worse in his face with this technique. And it just freaked me out a bit, to be honest. And you know, I put that on the web. Same day I made it, put it on the web, bored. Right, that's done. Whatever. And then you just start to sort of, well, what else can we do with this thing? So, you know, we go, yeah, well, you know, maybe we can, you know, do it in 3D and do some typography thing. And I like the original Batman movie. It's very kitschy. And it does this typographic thing. And you could watch the whole movie undulating typography. So it's kind of weird. Or, you know, this is Get Carter. And align all the frames so the actual depth of the frame is dependent on how much volume is in that scene. And then you get these kind of patterns going on. It's like, yeah, okay, fine. And then you go, yeah, maybe we can take a frame every second and then lay it out, make it print it out 8:3 pixels and then do like every row represents 1 minute of film time. I go, yeah. And then I go, hang on. This one's quite interesting, actually. So I started to look at this. And again, you know, this is like half an hour max to make this stuff. And I just did it. And the reason I write stuff so quick and don't really make dead complex things is because, you know, I get bored easily, you know, is the truth of it. I get bored and it's like, oh, and when I was writing my first book, which is a very technical flash book, you know, I got into writing it a month down the road. I'm like, Jesus Christ. It's like, I've got at least 10 other things I want to be doing with my evenings. And I was getting up at like 4 a.m. to write this thing. And it was like, oh, painful. Consequently, this one's full of pictures. So, so you can learn from your mistakes. So anyway, I did, you know, various different movies like this. And I thought it was quite interesting. This is Hitchcock's Vertigo. And that's the entire film. It's not every frame, it's every second. So, you know, people started to pick up on this. Jim picked up on it. It was on Kudo.com. I know a lot of people saw it from there. It was going to be in The Face, and they emailed me to say, you know, The Face magazine is a very famous magazine in the UK, or it was. And they emailed me to say, we want to feature it in The Face. I'm going, yes, I'm in The Face. Come on. Real, you know, culture, very famous magazine. And then I read the next day that The Face was closing down. I was like, shit. So, oh well. So I still tell people I was in The Face, but I wasn't really. Now the thing is, you know, what I love about this project that took like hardly any amount of time because, you know, I wanted to move on to other stuff. It was picked up in like national newspapers in the UK, not just design mags. And, John Walters, who's the editor of I Magazine, said this about it in The Guardian. Film students, academics, and obsessives with time on their hands may use Dawes's grids to postulate new theories about the language of film. I'm like, yes. Like, wow, really? Cool. And it's like, all right, I was just seeing what would happen if a load of, you know, put a load of screens. Or and I think if I was an artist and very serious and didn't tell jokes and stuff, I'd be going, yes, this, what I was trying to do was, you know, which is, sorry, I'm not like that. So, you know, so then you get like Howe in Chicago was a few years ago. And, they were like really banging on about me getting a session there. And, you know, I said, I'd love to do a session there. And they said, what are you going to do? And I said, I don't know. They said, well, we want something very different. So I'm looking around the room, and this is true. And I'm looking around the room, and there's this jar of Play-Doh on my shelf. And I said, I don't know. I'll interface Play-Doh with a computer. And they're like, wow, awesome. And I'm going, shit. Right, I'm saying, oh, Jesus. So that literally, no word of a lie. And I sort of knew how to sort of do it. Because, you know, I've got this, like, digital sketchbook of stuff where I saw and all these, like, short attention span experiments where I sort of know how I probably can pull this off, but not sure. But I've already, this session's in black and white on the web. So the night before the session, still hadn't, I'm terrible, I don't plan anything. The night before a session, I'm there in my hotel room with this webcam, and I managed to do it. So have we got audio on this? Yeah, here we go. And this is what it looks like. So this is all in real time. The amount of Play-Doh on screen dictates how fast the Kung Fu movie goes. So, the less Play-Doh on screen, the slower the movie plays. So it's running really slow now. So, and you can see as I manipulate it, you know, there's like this connection made with the video. And then consequently, you know, you can put it back. And it's normal speed now. Consequently, polar opposite, to put too much on there, and it speeds up, and the computer can't cope. Goes crazy. Now, the guy... Thank you. Now, the guy... Well, a guy came up to me at Howe. One person said, oh, God, it was like magic. And I was like, great, because I want to, you know, ourselves and Magnetic North, we want to create these magical experiences. And another guy came up to me and said, what's the point? Said, don't know, to be honest. I'm on drugs. It's like... It was just the fact that you know, let's see what would happen, you know, and that you could extrapolate this in so many different ways. Use it as a kid's toy, or, you know, some crazy video editing thing, or a music sequencer with different colored balls of clay, etc., etc. And it was just fun. It completely altered your attitude to what an interface can be for a computer, and that is really, really important. And, you know, it was like, you know, what didn't take that long to do. And then you've got really... How am I doing on time, Jim? Never I. Oh, we're cool. Right, so... Do things like this. So, I had the bottom of a McDonald's bag that I cut out, and I really like the icons on the bottom, which you'll see in a minute, where you see some of them there. I thought, that's actually, as a piece of design, really like that. I don't know why, but it sort of appealed to me. And I had this in my Moleskin book, you know, you have the envelope thing in the back, and I kept this for years. And I think it says somewhere it's from 2001. So this is an old project anyway. But I thought, and I was doing like looking at integrating Google into using the SOAP protocol and all that blah, blah, technical nonsense. And then, but I was like, what could I do with it? Well, let's take the world's most ubiquitous food company, McDonald's, and take the world's most ubiquitous search engine, Google, and fuse them. So that's what I did. It goes a little something like this. You get your results back as a series of burgers and fries. Right, so there's all your results. Completely unusable. I mean, but this taught me a lot about interfacing with Google and all that kind of stuff and doing that. So there was a, you know, there's a point to it. And the thing is, the other dividend is This went round the web. I still get loads of hits on this project. And it sort of like peaks and troughs. People forget about it. Then someone will suddenly discover it and it's on Gizmodo or something, or, you know, and you get, you know, hundreds and thousands of hits off this project that took, you know, no time at all to make and doesn't really make any sense. And, but then, you know, you go, ooh, that's quite funny. So let's do it again. So. You get your results sideways on. Why is the web always red like that way up? Because you can read it. But is the answer. But, you know, you could turn your laptop over. I think this looks far more sexy than Amazon myself. But if you're Swedish, you probably love this one. It's like a Swedish sauna. So I think I'm almost done. And then we'll take some questions. I want to... just end with this. This is my money side. This is a, and I think, you know, it goes back to what Jim was saying. This is all stuff because, you know, we like to dream. I was always the kid in class that, as I'm sure many of you were, that was staring out the window. I left school with no qualifications. I didn't see the point of a lot of the stuff. Like, I'd love mathematics now. Back then, the only time I ever got caned in school, because we had corporal punishment back then. The only time I got, that's the international symbol for caning. The only time I got caned in school was when I was messing about in math class, because I didn't know the context of what they were teaching me. We were learning logarithm tables. And I was like, what would you use these for? Just learn it, Dawes. And so I was always looking out the window, and I think we should have more of this. And it's Edgar Allan Poe. They who dream by day are cognizant of many things which escape those who dream only by night. And I think maybe we should all work in our pajamas. I'll leave it there and then we'll take some questions, Jim.
I think sort of the other thing that comes from the Poe thing, as we were talking about, is that, like, if you wake up in the morning and you write your dreams down, like, then you sort of remember them. But if you go take a shower, by the time you have coffee, they're completely gone. So I think maybe there's something about this notebooking idea, whether it's the book at Kudal or his drive full of crap, that, you know, that there's this idea of, you know, we don't know where creativity comes from and we don't really know how to harness it. So we gotta be as armed as we can. We gotta load up. We gotta take as much stuff as we can, you know. So take any questions if anybody has any. Oh, and there's a mic if somebody wants to say something.
Oh, and we have some books to give away for the best question.
Or so any
if there's
question.
Only one, you probably get 8 books.
Yeah. Unfortunately, they'll all be signed, so you won't get the unique one that's unsigned somewhere.
Yeah, there's not many unsigned in the world.
Yo.
We got a question on the mic, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
Hey,
go ahead.
How are you? Hey. Great presentation. I have a question for those of us that, I mean, we all, I think, have a pretty short attention span. We're all kind of freaking out. Oh, there's all these great things we could be doing. There is a point at which one needs to learn a set of skills in order to be able to achieve the next goal. He's saying, it took me half an hour, it took me an hour to program this great, yes, you know, McGoogle thing. But there was a point at which we needed to get there to achieve each of those skill sets necessary to get, you know, to be able to do that. So how does one... What are the tips that you guys have for getting those skill sets and keeping your attention focused long enough to at least be able to get the stuff necessary?
I think it's
there.
A great question. I think I sort of separated into two things. There's craft, and then there's sort of the creative part. And, you know, you can't build a house if you can't drive a nail. So, you know, you sort of have to have a set of skills, and those are developed by doing work and by doing work over and over again, whether it's typography or coding or editing videotape or whatever it is. So, you know, just make sure you don't lose your short attention span while you're learning how to set headlines, I guess. Is the idea.
Yeah, and I think it's also what level do you want to go to? I mean, I can do a bit of PHP, and I've done some like image manipulation stuff in PHP, but I'm not a PHP programmer. I just know a little bit, which, you know, you could be jack of all trades, master of none, but... it's important that you surround yourself with people who do craft, or you become one of the crafters. the craft is really, really important. The execution of the idea is really important. It's not just about the idea. So, with me, it's probably slightly different. I'm known for not, and Lou, my colleague and MD at MN is there, and she'll tell you I'm not a detail person because of this short attention span thing. But, I know what I want to achieve with a team. So, I'm sort of in a luckier position because I've got people who can, like, really talented people who can
pick up after you.
Yeah, pick up and mop up the mess, you know. So, but I would say this, learning the skills, it's how you apply the time, the spare time you've got. And it's that constraint thing again. I get the train to Manchester every day. That's like an hour journey. And I use that time to learn something pretty much every day. And that can be maybe a little algorithm or, you know, and in whatever language, it doesn't really matter. Or, you know, maybe I haven't used Photoshop for a while, so I need to sort of relearn a few things. And, well, because you get stuck in old ways, don't you? You know, so using that time, and you know you've got that constraint of like an hour, and it sort of focuses you down, and you can just, you know, rather than listening to music, I mean, actually wasting time is really important as well. But, you know, sometimes I will just fire up the laptop and, right, what do I want to achieve today? And I have sort of a little goal in mind, right, I can do this in an hour. So that's how I sort of learn stuff.
Next. So would you say, both, that what you do kind of is meandering with a purpose? Would it be a good way?
Yeah, that'd be a very good way to purpose, and sometime without a purpose. Yeah. He asked if it's if what we do is meander with a purpose.
And
I think we just meander, yeah.
Two quick other questions. Do you think that a good way to save on the learning curve is to ask other people to explain to you? This way you don't spend too much time reinventing the wheel?
Yeah, I mean, I think to have somebody with some experience teach you is much easier than teaching yourself. So.
And one last thing, when you did Pinsetter, was it oriented to kids, towards kids? Or?
Oh, we did. We have this thing on our site called Pinsetter where you could just order any letters you want in 1-inch buttons. And there's a lot of WTFs being ordered, by the way.
Yeah.
No, we didn't have any target audience. We were doing some buttons for somebody else, something else, and somebody said, you know, let's use this typeface and set the whole alphabet in. So we put it up and started selling buttons. So it seems like kids are ordering them a lot. They're going out of lunch boxes.
Well, I thought that, you know, it would be more fun for kids to learn their words, that if each kid would walk around with a word in pins on the...
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's not all the kids ordering the WTFs, but...
Yeah. Thanks.
You're welcome.
I had caught the beginning of the panel next door, and they were talking about Twitter and...
Oh, and you left there to come over here?
Yes,
That's
I did.
So cool.
Yes, I did.
You...
And I'm glad
book.
I did too. Yes.
Yeah, that could be one of those.
That's why I'm here.
We like you.
Anybody else with her?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, right.
No, they were talking about MyTube and YouTube and Twitter.
MyTube,
and MySpace,
get that registered, yeah.
I am, and then you all are talking about attention span. And so as a business owner, and this is particularly, and I'm not sure your background, Mr. Dawes, but for you, Jim, as a business owner and having had some problems in the past, I'm all for free time and talking about in book type stuff that we do now. But how do you manage Twitter and all that stuff that can be a time drain and get in the way of productivity?
I think it has to do with who your staff is. Like, I come in and if everybody's not browsing the web for stuff, I get pissed off. Like, I mean, our thing is completely the opposite. Part of your responsibility, if you're one of us at Kudal, is to be screwing around all day. Now, that doesn't mean that a lot of work doesn't get done, but I think if you were looking for a model for how we've structured our staff, you would look at it like a preschool Montessori, like where there's like a lot of personal responsibility, but there's also very little there. We don't hand out grades.
So have you had to put any, because we're in the same boat as you. We have most of our staff. We do a lot of surfing the web and finding out new stuff, and it's important in our job. But do you have to, have you had problems where you have to put constraints on that?
No, not at all. In fact, I mean, we at kudal.com, we publish links all day long. So it's like that's our engine. That's the heartbeat of the company. The people, all these people come to Kudal every day and they wind up buying jewel boxing or they wind up buying an ad on the deck. Or I get invited to speak here. Like, all these things come out of that. So, yeah, we always hire. I mean, like, it always takes us like 18 months to hire anybody. Like, we're so nervous about protecting our culture that we wind up bringing people in freelance, and then we back and forth about what, you know, they like. So usually lately we've been trying to find really smart interns and then brainwash them into our system as opposed to trying to convert somebody from somewhere else. So, no, we haven't had a problem, but you know, just like anything else, not everything's rosy. I mean,
thank you. Thanks for the book.
You're welcome.
She pretty much took my question, so I don't have anything really insightful to say.
But just want a book, right?
Yeah, I want a book. Yeah,
I want a book.
See how easy that is.
How do I get a book? You just ask for one. Yeah.
Thank you.
Until
thank
he's
you.
Done. Yeah.
You're too nice, mate. That's a problem.
Well,
oh, really,
I do have a question though. It is about the workflow and the office environment. You know, do you surround yourself with more people like yourself who don't have a really high attention span? I mean, it seems like in my company, I'm supposed to be leading a crew of people, but you know, I just feel like I'm really all over the place and depending on them a lot. And I serve more as a visionary.
Brendan, I have people who pick up after me. So, I mean, I do a share of work as well, but it is about ideas. You need a combination of different kinds of people, I think, to make it work. Especially, I mean, we do large identity projects for big corporations who expect the sort of hand-holding and all of that that goes with it. They don't know that behind the scenes that all that crap and hand-holding is all just for show, that we're actually just sitting at the bar arguing about their brand, and that's right. How we come up with the idea.
Yeah.
But there's this great story about, I can't remember his name, he's a very famous Japanese designer. He had like 50 designers who work with him, and he would get a project to name a product and an identity. And he would have all 50 of his designers work for a month and generate hundreds and hundreds of comps for the idea. And then they would go to the meeting, and the day before he would do one. And then he would go to the meeting and he would show all 500 of those comps and say, "See how hard we worked? Here's your logo." And he would show his. And it worked every single time. He's now in the pantheon. I can't remember his name. But so, yeah, so takes all kinds of people.
This is dangerous, starting to sound redundant, but I'll ask it anyway. In a group setting, when you're managing a team of people, when you're leading a team of people, how do you plug in this creative process so that you start bouncing ideas off of each other? And then how do you kind of corral it so at some point you haven't spent 32 hours talking about the ideas, but actually someone went off and did something? Yeah, what I hear a lot of is individual people and how their creative process goes, but how do you plug that into a team?
Talking.
Brendan's team is bigger than mine, so.
It's. One of the things we do is, you know, we talk a lot and show a lot of the stuff with each other, and we share our stuff with other people in the team who aren't necessarily working on that project. And we do that every week, and we show the work on a big screen. And it's important. That process is really, really important, because obviously everyone then inputs in stuff and you get insights that you've never thought of because you've got people who've never seen this project before. So. And as for the brainstorm technique, I got to be honest with you, we haven't got like at the moment, and it's something we are really looking into, but it's chaotic. You know, I'd love to tell you that we've got something like Frog has Frog Think, and, you know, love to have like MN Think or something, but, you know, we haven't at the moment. And we fly by the seat of our pants, to be honest, a lot of the time. And, you know, most of the time we sort of win pitches, so we're kind of lucky in that way. Sometimes we lose. I don't know if I've got any kind of secret formula. I don't know, Jim, if you've.
I think you just got to indoctrinate the whole team to feel like you're all pulling on the same end of the rope. And I mean, there's only 8 of us. It's not that big, and we all have similar sort of feelings about things.
So it's a cultural argument.
Yeah. I mean, we're as jealous about our culture as we are about the money we make. I mean, it's just as important for us to enjoy going to work. You know, there's a lot of this world that doesn't. And so for us, we think that that's important. I think at a certain size of a team, it's more difficult to manage sort of jealousy and sort of corporate or company-wide infighting. There may be 8 or 12. I don't know. You can talk, maybe this is a whole different subject. But
yeah.
The idea that everybody's pulling on the same end of the rope is a fragile one. But we don't have any brainstorming secrets either. Generally, what we do is we come up with the best thing we can come up with, and we say, we got to beat that one, and then when we can't beat it, we go to the bar. So, and then we try to do it where we actually call it conference room B. that way. It sort of feels like then you can even say it to the client. Yeah, we're going to have a big meeting over at conference room B, and generally we don't even talk about the project, but at least we like each other. So
One of the other things we do is we all sit together. We don't have separate rooms. We don't even have separate desks. So they're like the producers are sat, you know, with creatives and stuff. So, and that's just our way. And the cultural thing is totally. Jim was saying, you know, about 18 months to interview someone. You know, similar sort of thing where it's so hard to find people who will fit in with your culture. And you get one person who upsets that, and it's just like a chain reaction until you fire them. You know, so that's really important. The whole culture thing is probably the most important part of it, I'd say.
Hello. I was wondering how you balance the breadth and the depth. Like, you know, you got your fingers in all sorts of different pies. And when do you know it's time to wrap up a project or abandon, you know, the thing that you're, you know, they say you're never finished with a painting. You just abandon it. When do you know that you're done?
I don't know. There's a great quote from Truman Capote, who was a serial reviser. He revised everything forever and ever and ever. He was never happy with anything. And somebody asked him when he was done with the novel, and he said, when the guy from the publishing house comes to my house and takes it away. So I don't think we're actually that way. I don't know. I think sometimes, you know, this burst of enthusiasm for a new idea is really addictive. It's sort of this idea that it's easier to fall in love than it is to stay married. Like, there's this moment where you're really all over this idea. And, you know, you can sense that, and you can also sense the other part of it, I think. You sort of feel, like, at least in our non-monetary projects where we're just goofing on the web and doing something, you sort of feel like Photoshop Tennis. We had thousands and thousands of people came to see it all the time, but we weren't getting the satisfaction out of it anymore, and we wanted to try other things, so we sort of let it go. Now, I mean, rumor has it may be coming back, but I think you sort of know it with those. With client projects, you're done when you get the check, pretty much. So, I think.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about the idea of the book or the drive that you guys keep. Do you have friend designers that do the same thing? And have you ever thought of just kind of like trading for a week and just?
Oh no, we can't let anybody see the book. Yeah, no. No.
Want to try?
Jason Santa Maria is here somewhere, and he did a presentation yesterday about the importance of having the sketchbook, and I think maybe for slightly different reasons, but also to sort of document your thought process. And people at my firm do keep sketchbooks, but the book we keep about the ideas is sort of a collective thing, and I really mean it. We wouldn't show it to anybody. It's our thing, and that's maybe part of building that culture, is that we have this secret document, you know, sort of. Not really. We, you know, but that's how we feel about it.
Yeah, I'm the same. I think I'm all down with the whole open source thing, but to a point. So everyone can see I've just stole a lot of stuff as well. So no, joking.
Well, thanks everybody for coming. Enjoy the rest of your Sunday.
Thanks very much.